I don't agree completely with Lorna Strand. There are many more cases just as amazing as this one. Chapter 23, For Whom the Bell Tolls. God generates beings and sends them back over and over again, until they return to Him. The Quran. Belief in reincarnation is not limited to Buddhists and Hindus in Asia, it exists amongst North American Indians. Parapsychologists have recorded children in Canada who remember living before and who have birthmarks corresponding to events in previous lives. Emma Michelle, an 82-year-old member of the Wet'suwet'en tribe in British Columbia, told us a powerful story. Years ago, her small nephew Jimmy was playing on the floor when the bell began to toll in the small wooden church next door. The boy asked why the bell was ringing and was told it was because Donald G., a local man, was dead. The child said, "That's the one who hired men to beat me up and throw me in the river." The child was recalling the death of an uncle whose bearded body had been recovered from the nearby Bulkeley River, before the boy was born. Jimmy was accepted as the reincarnation of this uncle, but as a young man tragically met a similar death. He too was drowned in the turbulent river that dominates the village. The family say Jimmy has subsequently been reborn yet again as Emma's grandson, who as a small child had some memories of both drowned forebears. He used plaintively to wish he'd been born a girl, and therefore less likely to meet another violent death in the river. Emma's family was typical of the North American Indians' belief that people are mostly reborn within the same family. This poses a special problem for parapsychologists like Dr. Antonia Mills of the University of Virginia, who took us to meet Emma. It's very difficult in general to be sure the statement a child makes is not based on knowledge the child could learn from its parents or other relatives. Dr. Mills said a good case was often a combination of startling statements by the child, sometimes on matters unknown to the parents, and birthmarks, personal characteristics and medical conditions relating to the previous personality. Today, early 90s, Emma's grandson is a boy of 14, whose memories of another life have faded, but his mother and grandmother remember him as an infant. A car that once belonged to the dead Jimmy was standing derelict alongside the house. The boy was only two and he'd run around and tell my parents this was his car and the wheels were all flat. He'd kick the wheels and say, "Who did this?" Today, the youth complains of pains in his feet and knees which have stopped him playing football and meant he had to miss gym classes all last year. He is annoyed about this and has had to consult two doctors. His mother says this reminds her very much of her dead brother Jimmy. "My brother had a couple of operations and the one side of his foot was flat and he was always talking about his knees hurting him." Comparing reincarnation cases in Canada with Asia, there are clear similarities between the cultural beliefs of these North American Indians and the religious doctrines of the East. Perhaps that's not surprising. North American Indians are said to be the descendants of nomadic bands of Asian hunters who crossed the Bering Straits about 10,000 years ago during the Great Ice Age, when Asia and America were temporarily joined between Siberia and Alaska. Dr. Mills pointed out similarities between the Tibetan belief that senior lamas may choose to come back as Tulkas, and North American Indian high chiefs who sometimes choose to be reborn to help members of their family or clan. Both cultures also accept reincarnation of animals as well as humans, and these Indians, like the Tibetans, believe the mountains and the forest where they live are inhabited by spirits. Their land is a living thing. We filmed in an area of magnificent forested mountains, lakes and waterfalls, where two small tribes live along the banks of the Skeena and Ulkeley rivers. Traditionally they hunted game in the forest and fished for salmon in the rivers, which still boil with sockeye and spring salmon returning to spawn. In the rocky gorge at Morisha Town, the water breaks over great boulders where gleaming Indian fishermen, half hidden in spray, precariously try to spear the leaping and darting fish. In the flurry of a catch, it's easy to slip off the wet rocks and be swept away. Some for safety have a line tied round their waist, with the other end held hopefully by a strong colleague on the shore. These fishing spots are prized, a source of wealth, and there is a strict pecking order. A chief of the Wet'suwet'en tribe told me that anyone fishing in his spot would have to move when he appeared. It had been a dispute between families over fishing rights that led to the murder in the river which Jimmy told Emma about. It was claimed that the drowned man, son of a chief, acted as if he already had the same rights as his father during the chief's lifetime. After a day's fishing, the young man went to collect some traps and was not seen alive again. Today, there are only 1,000 Wet'suwet'en in the valley and about 5,000 Gitxsan nearby. There is a Christian church in each village and many 102 Indians attend services. It might look as if their old belief in reincarnation has been supplanted by Christianity, but appearances are deceptive. We met numerous Indian churchgoers who believe in reincarnation, and a reborn chief who is also a born-again Christian. The Indians see no contradiction in accepting Christianity and continuing to believe in reincarnation. There are several distinctive features about reincarnation beliefs amongst the tribes. Often there is an announcing dream by some senior member of the family which reveals the identity of the one who is to be reborn. Sometimes, apparitions of the dead person are seen. At birth, the old people scan every inch of the baby for signs of telltale birthmarks, and as the child grows up they keep a close watch to see if he or she behaves like the dead person. Sometimes an individual tells a family in advance how he or she intends to be reborn. For example, Fern was a small child when a member of her clan visited her grandmother's house and announced his intention. "He was a relative of my grandmother and he just looked at me and said he was going to come back to me, as my child. I was just a young girl, and was terrified of this man. Every time I saw him on the street, I'd hide and wait for him to pass and then run home." Years later, Fern had a son and her grandmother told her the child was this man come back. She pointed to birthmarks around the ears of the baby which resembled the pierced ear marks of a chief. These marks are still clearly visible on Fern's son, and Dr. Mills photographed them for her records. Fern said she'd had no idea the old man in question had even had pierced ears. However, she was more impressed by an outburst from her son when he was about 3 years old. The boy's grandmother, now dead, recorded the incident in a written statement for Dr. Mills. "The child became furious when he discovered the old man's house had been pulled down and that his widow had remarried. He demanded to know who had taken down the house and said he would kill the second husband. The three-year-old was asked how he proposed to do that. He went to the kitchen and came back with a butcher's knife." Dr. Mills commented, "In a number of cases the evidence is difficult to explain. For example, where children have pierced ear marks, they are not something that would be genetically transmitted or explained by our current understanding of biology. It's interesting in this case that the mother did not know the previous personality had pierced ears, so it's not a question of a mother willing it, not caused by a maternal impression, which is an alternative explanation for birthmarks." A man who was having his pierced ear marks photographed by Dr. Mills told us about an experience with an apparition. In 1969, when he was a boy, his uncle Carl was missing and there was a big search. Carl's body was eventually found hidden amongst logs in the dock at Prince Rupert. He'd been murdered, but the body wasn't found for 3 weeks and the family became very anxious. One day, the telephone rang. The 12-year-old boy picked it up and heard his uncle Carl ask if there had been any messages for him. The boy was shocked and held the telephone away from his ear. Carl had a kind of hysterical laugh when he thought there was something funny, and my father and others around the room heard him laughing down the telephone. Some nights later, the boy believed he saw Carl come through a glass door and stand in front of him and again ask if there had been any telephone calls. Then he vanished. At a chief's house, Dr. Mills talked to a small group of women, all chiefs and all reincarnates. Dr. Mills asked a woman how she knew that her daughter Barbara, who was present, was reincarnated. "By her thumbnail. My grandmother had an accident and it split her thumbnail and lasted all her life. Barbara showed us her thumbnail, a very clear ridge runs down it, which we filmed. She accepted she was her own great-grandmother and said as a child she had a special relationship with the son of the dead woman. He knew a lot of things and had ways of knowing I was his mother. He just assured me of his love for me. In her own life, Barbara has found herself retracing old steps. The great-grandmother was leader of a local rebellion and a healer. Today, Barbara is a leader of the blockade movement pressing for land reform and she helps run a center for holistic healing. Barbara's grandson, now aged 11, is believed to be the reincarnation of an hereditary chief named Peter Milton, who told three cousins before he died that he intended to come back. On the morning the child was born, in another part of Canada, one of the cousins told Barbara's mother she had just had a dream announcing that Peter Milton had been reborn. A little later, a telephone call said a baby boy had been born. He had three pierced ear marks, similar to the earrings worn by Peter Milton. When the child was about three, he was brought to the area and he showed some interest in seeing where Peter Milton had lived. The infant was in his family home when there was a knock at the door. It was Alice, one of the three cousins Milton had spoken to about coming back. The child had never seen her before. We were here in the kitchen and Auntie usually knocked and walked in. As soon as she opened the door, the little boy walked up to her and gave her a punch. Georgia was very upset, but Alice said, "Don't be upset, I have something to tell you." She gathered us around this table and told us that before Peter Milton passed away, his cousins had asked how they would recognize him when he came back. He said, "I'll give Auntie Alice a punch." 103 Dr. Mull's research followed in the footsteps of Dr. Ian Stevenson in British Columbia. They have made several surveys of reincarnation cases amongst the Indians and I asked Dr. Mills for her conclusions. I began seeing that the belief in reincarnation among the Indians suggested a totally different concept of personality than the concepts I had been trained to think of. They talked about personality in terms of who they were before. They were saying a person comes back bringing the traits they had at the end of their previous life. The Beaver Indians particularly think when a person dies violently or suddenly, he or she has a hard time finding the trail to heaven. When the person dies in a confused state, they linger around as discarnate beings, a kind of ghost. A lot of people see apparitions of such a person until the person is reborn. They believe people who find the trail to heaven and stay there for a considerable time, also come back. But it is so long after their death on the earth plane, they no longer have any memories of a previous identity. But their personality characteristics are still the result of who they were before. So even when they don't know who they were before, their personality is an accumulation of qualities from previous lives. This was a very interesting worldview. Some of the more difficult cases are explained by the native concept of reincarnation. The question is whether reincarnation is the only explanation that would account for these phenomena. I have not been able to think of an explanation for the phenomena in some cases other than reincarnation, but what reincarnation is, how it operates, that's not fully understood. Most anthropologists approach the beliefs of native people in terms of what does a tradition give a people? They have not looked at whether there is any validity to these beliefs and sometimes they assume they are in fact incorrect. I don't think we're justified in making those kind of assumptions. This belief deserves a careful analysis. We're only on the threshold of understanding the impact on people of culture, of mind, of what people believe. We are past the colonial era where we can presume to know better. Chapter 24, A Fear of Thunder. End and beginning are dreams, birthless and deathless and changeless remaineth the spit forever. Death hath not touched it at all, dead though the house of it seems. Bhagavad Gita. The song Celestials translated by Sir Edwin Arnold. In a tropical thunderstorm, a frightened three-year-old girl told her parents she had been killed in a previous life by a landslide caused by torrential rain. From her account, researchers identified a disaster some years before, in which 28 people died, and they found a victim who matched the child's description of this early life. This was one of four dramatic stories of previous lives which sent us to Sri Lanka in November 1990. These were strong cases because each child's memories were written down before anyone discovered whose lives they might be talking about. And it was the researchers, mostly by good detective work, not the families concerned, who identified the dead people the children remembered. 142 of the cases were investigated by Dr. Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia, and both were children who recalled earlier lives in poor circumstances, a blow to those who pretend Stevenson's cases are all about poor families trying to scrape up an acquaintance with wealthier ones. The other cases, equally fascinating, were researched by Professor Erlander Haraldsson of the University of Iceland. Stevenson's second case was another 3-year-old girl who said she was the daughter of a flower seller and had drowned after being pushed into a river by a dumb boy. It sounded an unlikely scenario, but the researchers verified the facts. Stevenson's published verdict on both cases was that the evidence showed the children obtained correct information about deceased persons by some paranormal process. Our introduction to the child who remembered a landslide disaster was dramatic. We arrived at the parents' home in Sri Lanka in one afternoon to record an interview with Subhashini, now aged 10, when she arrived home from school. Her schoolteacher parents, well-educated and quite prosperous, live in a pleasant house at the end of a forest track. Their daughter still has a fear of thunderstorms and, as we were talking to her parents, a tropical storm broke. The father took a large umbrella and rushed off to meet his daughter as the track swiftly turned into a stream. When Subhashini arrived, sheltering close, against her father, we talked to her about her phobia as the storm raged in the background. Today Subhashini's memories have almost completely faded, but her parents' recollections are vivid. They talked to Godwin Samararatne, a skilled researcher frequently used by Dr. Stevenson to investigate Sri Lankan cases. The parents recalled that their daughter was 3 years old when she began to speak of another life as the daughter of tea pickers on a plantation at Sinhapitiya, Gampala, almost 100 kilometers from their home. The child said that one night in a great storm there was a noise like Gudu, and her mother told her to take a torch and go outside to see if the mountain was falling down. The child said simply, "I took a torch and went outside and came here." Subhashini had described tea bushes, which she could not have seen growing anywhere near her home, and made gestures to show how tea was picked. She said that tea pickers lived in lines, rows of terraced shacks. She talked about Tamil workers, who are the poorly paid descendants of Hindus from India, brought over in the 19th century by British tea planters as cheap labor for their highland estates. She talked so frequently about Tamils that the neighboring children began teasing her, saying she had been a Tamil in a previous life. Little Subhashini got very angry and made it clear that her family had been Sinhalese Buddhists. The child was still only 3 when Dr. Stevenson's other researcher in the area, Tissa Jewardane, heard about her story, visited the family and began to record her statements. Subhashini described life in the lines in some detail. There was a water tap in the yard that irritated her mother because it would not stop dripping. Her father had a pot belly. She had an older brother and sister as well as a younger brother and sister. On the night of the storm, her older brother returned home but left because his supper wasn't ready and so escaped the disaster. Outside the shack, in the dark with her torch, the child had become trapped. Subhashini had named the area where the disaster occurred, and her schoolteacher father was then told by a relative about a serious accident on a tea plantation in that district some years before. The father was invited to a wedding in this area and thought it would be a good opportunity to investigate. Stevenson's written report says, Subhashini's father took her along a road on the tea estate where he had been told the landslide had occurred. However, Subhashini became frightened, screamed and refused to go on, saying she was afraid of being trapped. They turned back and did not meet any of the families who had lost members in the landslide. It didn't take Stevenson's researchers long to get to grips with the facts of the disaster, which happened in October 1977, just over 2 years before Subhashini was born. The Ceylon Daily Mirror carried a story and a picture of coffins of those victims they managed to find after a landslide that killed 28 people. The researchers established that there had been no other landslips in the area within living memory. The report of the official inquiry into the disaster yielded an important fact. There was just one Sinhalese Buddhist family living in the limes alongside Tamil families. The mother and father of this family were killed, and so were their three youngest children. One was a little girl, Devi Malika, aged about 7, who seemed to fit Subhashini's descriptions. On the night of the storm, an older brother had returned home but had gone out again before the landslip occurred and escaped unharmed, as did another sister who was not at home that evening. Godwin Samararatne analyzed Subhashini's 32 recorded statements of fact and found that 25 fitted the life of Devi Malika, according to surviving relatives and a family friend. Of the 7 other facts, some were simply unverifiable, like the child's claim that her mother had asked her to take a torch and look outside. No one from the house survived to bear witness. The child had correctly said that an older brother left the house before the disaster, but the boy told researchers he left at the request of his father, not because his supper was not ready. This largely accurate statement was therefore classified as unverified, which indicates how scrupulous the researchers were in weighing the facts. In 1986, Samararatne and Jayawardhan tried an experiment. They took Subhashini and her parents to the 105 plantation manager's office, where she met a group of people, including surviving relatives. Would she be able to identify relatives from the previous life? It was a partial success. Subhashini, whose memories might have been starting to fade at the age of 6, said nothing about her sister or a neighbor, but correctly said a young man present was her older brother. It was an important identification, but it was flawed, as Stevenson acknowledged. Subhashini's recognition of the brother was marred because he pushed himself forward from a group and stood in front of her. Godwin Samararatne then asked her, "Who is he?" Thus, although she had no verbal clue to his identity, she might have inferred that he was an older member of the family. To capture something of that terrible night in October 1977, our team visited the landslide site. The manager, Mr. I.B. Herrett, drove us up a steep mountain path in a four-wheel drive vehicle. The hillsides were covered with neat, low bushes of tea all the way up to the mountain tops. The higher the tea grows, the better the quality and the higher the price. Nothing seems to have changed. The workers, nearly all Tamils earning low wages, lived in lines, squalid rows of shacks on small plateaus cut into the hillside. Chickens strutted about the yards, outside taps seemed still to drip, and children with large brown eyes gazed back at us from every doorway. The site of Devi Malika's home was completely overgrown. Herod told us what happened on the night of the disaster. After 4 days of rain, there was a thunderstorm about 8 o'clock in the evening of 27 October. Suddenly huge granite boulders, weighing several tons, went slithering down the mountainside in a tide of mud. The lines were engulfed and partly swept down the hillside for another 250 yards and buried. Half the bodies were never recovered, including those of Devi Malika and her family. The older brother and sister still work on the plantation, and we talked to them alongside the disaster area. They showed us how their family, when drinking tea, put a little sugar on the palm of the hand and lick it as they drink. The family couldn't afford to buy enough sugar to put in a cup. This was the way Subhashini drank tea at home when she was small, which used to baffle her present parents. I couldn't help thinking that the Subhashini I met in her school uniform, protected against the rain by her father's umbrella, has a much better deal from life than the child whose bones were somewhere down the hillside below us, probably under one of those neat tea bushes. In the second Stevenson case, we looked at Yusitha, the 3-year-old daughter of a village tailor who heard someone mention the name Kataragama and said, "I used to live there." She was referring to a town 200 kilometers distant from her home at Pugala, near Colombo. In 1984, Yusitha told her parents her father had sold flowers near a Buddhist temple, which she named. She had lived near a river and a dumb boy had pushed her in, and she drowned. Within a year, Tissaji Wadane heard about the Yuzithu and began to record her statements. He went to Kataragama, a place of pilgrimage famous for its Buddhist and Hindu temples, with a river running through the middle. At the police station, Tissu asked if there was anyone who sold flowers, perhaps had a dumb boy in the family. He was directed to lines of stalls near a Buddhist temple. At one of them he was told the flower seller's daughter Naimal Kanthai had drowned in the river in 1974 when she was nearly 2 years old. She had been playing with her two brothers, one of whom was dumb. Godwin Samararatne also recorded information from Yuzitha. The child spoke of dogs which were tied up near her home and fed meat, which sounded most unusual because Buddhists do not usually eat meat and rarely keep dogs as pets. In Sri Lanka there are many dogs, but they are usually strays who scavenge for food. However, the child was correct. A neighbor of Naimal Kanthai's family was a hunter who kept his dogs tied up and fed them on the meat he caught. The child also described how her father was a part-time priest in a temple and took part in coconut smashing ceremonies. The child waved her arms about to show how it was done. In Kataragama, we filmed at the temple where the dead girl's father assisted at ceremonies. Coconuts were set on fire and then ceremonially smashed in the way the child had described, symbolizing the solving of life's problems. To make sure they had found the correct family, Stevenson went around every one of the 20 stalls in the road and asked each family if they had a dumb boy or had lost a child through drowning. Yuzitha made 30 statements of fact, of which 28 were verifiable, and 23 were correct for the life of Naimal Kanthai. At the flower stall we filmed a sad-faced young man cleverly opening out the petals on blooms and making a vivid display. He was the dumb brother. The most poignant moment for us came when Naimal Kanthai's mother led the way across the field to a river and showed us where she had been washing clothes on the bank while the little girl played with her two brothers. 16 years on from the day of the tragedy, the dumb boy, who had been unable to tell his mother of the terrible accident, looked on sadly and there were tears in the mother's eyes. Our quartet of Sri Lankan children who seemed to remember previous lives was completed by two remarkable six-year-olds. Juminder, a serious little boy, chanted obscure Buddhist texts in Pali, a language used only in religion, and behaved like the abbot he might once have been. Dilakshi, a little girl treasured by two sets 106 of parents, pointed to the river where she says she drowned in an early life. We were introduced to them both by Professor Erlander Haraldsson of the University of Iceland, who emphasized that the children's recollections were recorded well in advance of any previous personality being found. Both sets of parents tried initially to play down their children's stories. Dewminder's tale seemed most far-fetched. The little boy recalled the life of a monk who had a motor car, an elephant and a money bag. Property is routinely forbidden to monks, so it was an unlikely description, but Dr. Haraldsson found a corresponding real-life version. For Dilakshi, a matching past life came to light only after her story was published in a newspaper and read by the father of a drowned girl. Dilakshi, an only child, was 2 years old in 1986, when she began to upset her parents by refusing to call them mother and father. She called her mother Klutch or aunt. The infant wanted to be taken to her real mother and her real home in Damula, over 100 kilometers distant. Her parents scolded the child to get her to stop this talk, but she replied that her real parents never shouted at her. They used to call her darling or sweet little daughter. Dilakshi insisted she had once drowned in a river near Damula. Eventually her worried parents contacted the high priest of the Damula temple. His inquiries came to nothing and he passed the problem to a feature writer with the newspaper Weekend, Mr. I.W. Abapala, who printed a full account of the girl's story. This was read by a man in the Damula district. Dilakshi's story of a drowning echoed the circumstances of his own daughter's death in September 1983, 1 year before Dilakshi was born. He and his wife wanted to meet the girl who might be the reincarnation of their daughter Shyarami. In a busy newspaper office in Colombo, a Bapala told the story of how he took Dilakshi and her parents to meet the other family. It was a long walk along rutted paths to the remote house where Shyromi had lived, and little Dilakshi led the way confidently. She was met by a group of people.